Welcome to a special Friday edition of the Bulwark Podcast. Our episode today is brought to you by Grove Collaborative. I'm going to be talking with former Congressman David Jolly. But first, we have a little bit of business that we have to transact. And I just have to, you know, this is what you needed. By the way, good morning, David. Good to have you back.
Good morning, Charlie. Good to be with you. I want to hear your business. What's happening?
Well, I know what we really need, what you really wanted on a Friday morning was just a little bit of Frank Sinatra.
Regrets, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I...
Okay, well, so maybe we've had more than just a few, but I noticed that somebody on Twitter put up flashback from The Bulwark, January 11th, 2019. This was our first week, or maybe our second week of publication. And the headline was, actually, the GOP needs more Elise Stefanik's. Stefanik is not the Republican we deserve, but she's the Republican we need. And, you know, I have to admit, David, it didn't age the way I was hoping that it would age. But
no, if it's any comfort, you weren't the only one fooled, though.
Well, but see, this is the thing. It's I've gotten used to disappointment. It's when I say we've had a few regrets, it does seem like we've done this before, right? It's like, okay, no, this person's going to stand up. Okay, well, this is going to be this person's moment to show a little bit of conscience. And no, but I have to admit that there were a lot of hopes in Elise Stefanik, but it does really tell you something about the nature of the Republican Republican Party politics right now, and where the party's going. That somebody, that sort of the best and the brightest, and somebody who, I don't know, had a lot of high expectations, would now be lumped in with Mark Meadows and Jim Jordan.
It is, you know, from my experience, if I were to try to put a finger on what we're seeing, there's some inside ball game going on. And what I mean by that is, for members of Congress who come through a very competitive electoral process, and she did, she flipped a seat and she was somebody that the party invested in. You are in a certain club, we'll use the word, and members don't really want to be in the club. They want to be in safe seats, right? Mm-hmm. But as a result, the way you see members who are in hyper-competitive seats function is rarely to try to work across the aisle and be cross-partisan. That's what I tried to do. And, you know, though I was redistricted, look, I was abandoned by the party once I started to try to act in a cross-partisan manner. The more likely behavior of members like Elise and others who are in that group is to become hyper-partisan because they become so protected and loyal to the machinery of the National Republican Congressional Committee that funds their campaign. They hook on to the leader, Kevin McCarthy, and basically their goal is to make sure Kevin McCarthy and the NRCC is happy with them so that they can continue to get through the process every 2 years. That is informing, I think, some of her decision making. But here's the question I have about Elise and all of the other members that engage in these questions of misdirection. And understand, they are misdirection. Elise's moment with Ambassador Yovanovitch is a perfect example of what I don't know if it is strategy or ignorance and intellectual shortness, if you will. When Elise Stefanik hooked on the fact that the president can hire or fire ambassadors at will and demanded that Yovanovitch clearly answer that question, and she said, yes, that's true, Stefanik acted like that was an aha moment that exonerated the president. And in the presser afterwards, that was her point. I am glad that we all agree the president has the right to fire the ambassador. That is true in isolation, but it overlooks that if a president does that with corrupt intent or as part of a corrupt conspiracy, the underlying corruption is still impeachable. I think Elise knows that. And so my question is, why would you willfully engage in misdirection? And this is where it's okay for us as the American people in this moment to judge not just the president, but the behavior of Republicans like Elise Stefanik and her colleagues.
But, you know, we can talk about how they should be embarrassed and how they will pay a price for it. But, you know, she's made the calculation and others have made the calculation that they've created such an effective alternative political reality that she's not only not shamed by this, that she's rewarded, that she is a celebrity as a result of this. And you can tell that she's feeding on this. So rather than being embarrassed by some of this, they are embraced and they become rock stars. I mean, the whole Lindsey Graham phenomenon is a pretty good example, you know, where Lindsey Graham was so clear in his position on Trump. And yet when he became, debased himself the most dramatically is when his stock rose the most within the party itself. So the reward system has been turned on its head, hasn't it?
It has. And to the extent it reflects us as a nation, I think it's clear we are a broken and divided nation. And we are seeing that now in our leaders, because that is the behavior that is being rewarded. Now, I can put my political science hat on and say it's a result of emerging mass media over the past 20 years of gerrymandering that incentivizes hyperpartisanship, closed primaries, big money, all of that. But at some point, it also just is a human integrity moment and a leadership decision.
Yeah.
You know, when Lindsey Graham in the last cycle said the way to make America great again is to tell Donald Trump to go to hell,
Yeah. That
was the real Lindsey Graham. And if there is anything real in what we're seeing now about Lindsey Graham, it is not the words he's saying in protection of the president. That's not real. But what may be real, sadly, is that we have a United States senator who is willing to act disingenuously in front of the American people, who is willing to act without his own convictions for the sake of his own reelection. And that is the worst trait in politics. You know, yesterday I quoted John Bolton to John Bolton to try to say that he has a higher calling in this moment. He needs to talk to the country. When John Huntsman went to work for Barack Obama, Bolton took a swipe at Huntsman and said, it's not your patriotic duty to advance the interests of a politician whose values are antithetical to your own. That is not the calling of patriotism. Those are John Bolton's words. Lindsey Graham, Elise Stefanik, and frankly, John Bolton himself in this moment should listen to John Bolton of 2011, not the Republican Party of 2019.
I'm going to circle back on John Bolton, but let's stick with Lindsey Graham for a moment, because one of our colleagues, Barry Rubin, who's the Bulwark senior video editor, has put together this new Twitter handle called Lindsey Graham's Fake Conscience. And today it had it's good stuff. It's all the old quotes from Lindsey Graham, that are actually, you know, obviously ironic and kind of hilarious, except today he posted something that really is kind of heartrending, because it really does show the personal cost of all of this. And, you know, this comes the day that it's apparent that Lindsey Graham is going to launch this investigation into the Bidens, that he is going to give Donald Trump the investigation into the Bidens that he was not able to coerce out of the Ukrainians. But in the video that Barry has posted, and I strongly urge people to go to Twitter to see this, it's a video of Lindsey Graham pre-Trump talking about his relationship with Joe Biden, and it runs about a minute. And just as you listen to this, think about, you know, what must be going through Lindsey Graham's mind or soul as he's deciding that, he's going to go all in the attack on Joe Biden and members of Joe Biden's family. Let's play this.
If you can't admire Joe Biden as a person, then it's probably you got a problem. You need to do some self-evaluation. Because what's not to like? I called him after Bo died. And he basically said, well, Bo was my soul. I've talked for a long time. He came to my ceremony and said some of the most incredibly heartfelt things that anybody could ever say to me. And he's the nicest person I think I've ever met in politics. He is as good a man as God ever created. I think he's been dealt a really gut blow. I think he focuses on what he's got to do, not what he lost. His heart's been ripped out, but he's going to make sure that the other members of his family is well taken care of. And he started talking about his grandkids. More worried about them than anything. We just talked about the future.
Yeah.
He started talking about the future of his family.
You know, here's a guy who clearly, on a human level, You know, that you know, somewhere in there, there's still Lindsey Graham, the human, right, David, who respects Joe Biden, who thinks that he's a good man, who knows his family, and yet is willing to go this far in service of Donald Trump.
I don't know what we can believe about Lindsey Graham. I don't know that he was true in his affection for Joe Biden. You have to wonder, was he using that moment to advance Lindsey? Listen, Lindsey Graham called Donald Trump a fraud, terrible for the nation. We deserve what we get if we elect him. In reality, Lindsey Graham has become Donald Trump. Lindsey Graham is Donald Trump, just with a softer Southern edge. Because consider what we get from Lindsey Graham these days. Zero ideological conviction, zero political conviction, a willingness to abandon your friends, to throw people under the bus, to say something completely antithetical to what you were saying just weeks or months or years before. It is a different package. It comes across a little more like sweet tea than it does stiff bourbon. But the reality is, what we get from Lindsey Graham is exactly what we get from Donald Trump these days. And if we're going to judge the lack of character, lack of fitness, and the inability to lead the nation in this moment when we talk about Donald Trump, we should apply exactly the same standard to Lindsey Graham. And okay. I say that as somebody who had great respect for Lindsey Graham, who traveled the world with him, who's gone down to the Syrian border with him, who believed in Lindsey Graham. And I kept my powder dry for the first couple of years. But what we have seen from Lindsey Graham is advancing the destruction that Donald Trump is bringing to the country. And we have to hold Lindsey Graham accountable just as we do the president.
Let's talk about where we're at on impeachment right now. The House Intelligence Committee has wrapped up its hearings. They don't have any more public hearings scheduled. Doesn't mean they won't have any. They're going to be basically passing the baton to the Judiciary Committee. It seems pretty obvious now that the House is going to be voting to impeach the president probably by the end of the year, and it's going to go to the Senate. So feel free to push back on any of this, because here's my take today. The two things are obvious. At the same time, that these impeachment hearings so far were devastating for Donald Trump. I think they made a very, very powerful case. So Democrats largely accomplished what they wanted. That's number one. Number two, because the Republican support is rock solid, the impeachment hearings were also a win for Trump in a sense. And despite all of these self-humiliations that we've been talking about, the Republicans also accomplished what they wanted. So I know, and I'm fighting against the cynicism, but, you know, we're at this moment where, even though Politico says this morning, even as Democrats felt they had made an ironclad case that Trump had abused the power of his office by pressuring a foreign government to interfere in the 2020 election, they were no closer to persuading even a single House Republican to join them in voting to impeach the president. And I think the dagger there was Will Hurd. So do you disagree with any of that?
Right. Yeah, and I think Adam Schiff summarized it well in one line in his close yesterday when he said, the difference between the Nixon impeachment and the Trump impeachment is not a difference of presidential behavior. They were both crooks. The difference is the Congress. We had a Congress in 1974 where people could look beyond party. And in 2019, that's simply not the case. I do think, as we know that the Senate, you know, if we exclude people like Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz and others, but if you think more of the Mitt Romneys, the Johnny Isaacsons, though he's losing, but are leaving, Senator Burr, Murkowski, others. I think the argument will soften as it goes to the other side of the Capitol. And it will not be that the president's behavior wasn't impeachable, because Republicans are afraid to even suggest the president did anything wrong. It is rare for anybody to say that. Will Hurd got the closest yesterday, saying it was improper and he wouldn't have done it that way. But I think there's going to be a slight variation of that. And what they're going to do is, instead of saying it's not impeachable, they're going to say it wasn't proven. Mm-hmm. And I think that will ultimately, as the spotlight comes in harsher and harsher on Republicans' decision making, there is a case they can make, though I don't believe it, particularly when we have a confession of the president, where they can go to Republican-leaning voters and say, Democrats simply didn't make the case. They never brought the whistleblower. They never brought the Bidens. They didn't allow this procedurally. Nobody actually spoke to the president. Nobody heard the president make the explicit direction. And if we're talking about impeaching a president, we need greater evidence than what we have now. Mm-hmm. Now, that requires you to say, well, if you want clearer testimony, why won't Pompeo and Mulvaney testify, right? Mm-hmm. The president's obstructing the whole process himself. But I do think that's the only digestible argument that a lot of Republican senators with a shred of integrity will feel comfortable as their narrative, that it wasn't proven.
Wouldn't the stronger argument be, okay, yes, this did occur, it was improper, but let's leave this to the voters? That removal from office is too extreme a step. I get an email from a guy from Missouri this morning who was at the courthouse talking to some, you know, prospective jurors, and he said everybody there believes that, yeah, Donald Trump did it, that they're satisfied that the case has in fact been proved. But to a person, they all thought that, yeah, but they're not in favor of impeachment and removal because there's an election coming up and removing the president is just too extreme. That seems to be the sweeter spot. So here's the question that I have for you, though. That given where we're at right now, that they haven't got a single Democratic vote, and I think that I think the testimony has been incredibly compelling. It's been incredibly convincing. I mean, even, you know, Peggy Noonan is out in the Wall Street Journal of all places saying that absolutely they've made the case. But you know, you make the point, all the people that have not yet testified, I mean, we haven't heard from Giuliani, Pence, Pompeo, Mulvaney, Bolton, all of those folks are out there. So I guess the question is, should the Democrats maybe slow their roll a little bit to find out what is out there, to keep drawing this case out? New York Times editorial board has a pretty strong position saying, look, it's essential for the House to conduct a thorough inquiry, including hearing testimony from critical players who have yet to appear. And right now, you know, they're not scheduling any testimony. This is a mistake. No matter is more urgent. It should not be rushed. And is there a case to be made that there are so many promising leads out there? Don't rush this thing through, so that the Republicans sort of can hide behind that you didn't do a thorough enough investigation, because it does seem like people are coming out of the woodwork. We haven't seen all of the documentation, and it is conceivable that there are other angles, because every day, rather surprisingly, we got some news. So what about slowing the roll a little bit?
Sure, and add to that that if the intent of McConnell and Trump is for a fast 2-week trial and the Senate is not going to take it seriously, then what is the rush, right? To your point, if we need the nation to more fully understand what happened, that will happen in the House perhaps in a greater way than it would happen in the Senate. You know, I made the case early on, even after the Mueller report, and I'm very strongly in favor of impeachment, even before the Ukraine matter. But I made the case, set a deadline for the vote and tell the White House, you're playing on our field, we're not playing on yours. If you don't testify, we're going to draft obstruction articles, and that's how we're going to go down. I still think that works if you lean into the obstruction piece of this, and if you create such urgency around the testimony the White House is obstructing, that all of history remembers that as much as they remember the entire narrative of trying to cheat in the next election by kneecapping Joe Biden. I also think, for instance, they should make urgent demands for the full transcript of the Ukraine call and let the White House say no, but history needs to record that there is more to the summary the White House put out. Don't accept for all of history, that that summary is somehow truthful, because we know in the Trump administration there's more there. So if Democrats were to create urgency around this obstruction, and, you know, they have to kind of take this one step at a time, they're creating urgency over the underlying facts right now, then perhaps you move to a vote and you send it to the Senate and you create the obstruction article around this. If you're not going to do that, then to your point, Charlie, and to the New York Times, you may as well let this play out into next year. Now, Democrats are coming up against their own politics, which is the politics of New Hampshire and Iowa and South Carolina, and they have a decision they have to make there. I will say, to one of your earlier points in that question, the case to be made that just let the voters decide, or some say it's not impeachable, that's too high of a punishment. As a country represented by two major parties, if we will accept through consensus of the two parties that, yes, it was wrong, but have disagreement over the penalty, we're in a great place. That's fine. That's a rational conversation. the heartbreak for me that I, Charlie, I have struggled with now for a week or two, that the facts are so clear. We know what happened. The president admitted to it. It's been corroborated by everybody who comes before the Congress. To have a nation unwilling to agree and recognize the truth, that's where I believe we're broken as a country. And this is on us. I don't know what this means for us as a country if we're unwilling to accept the truthfulness of the president's wrongdoing. If we can agree on that and then debate the penalty, that's fine. We are on a great course as a nation. We're on the wrong course if we can't agree that what the president did was wrong. And as we look to representatives on the Republican side of the Intelligence Committee, I think that's why so many of us found it maddening, but also heartbreaking, because I don't know where we go if that is one of the major data points in 2019, that one of the two major parties is unwilling to accept the truth simply for the sake of tribalism.
I could not agree with you more. And this is, I started the week, you know, thinking that one of the themes of the week is going to be the annihilation of truth. And it is the embrace of these bizarre conspiracy theories by people like Devin Nunes and the president who called into Fox and Friends. But you're absolutely right. It's like, it's one thing to live in the same moral universe where we can agree that if A is bad and if somebody commits A, these should be the consequences. And frankly, we were there in the 1970s, you know, for all the terrors of Watergate. There was at least a shared set of facts and a shared moral universe. There were, you know, disagreements within the, you know, have you proved it? But if we're at this point now where truth has been absolutely battered and raped through the process, then the damage is going to be long, is going to be long lasting. I was looking for David Frum, who has an analysis of the way in which Republicans have gone down this sort of alternative reality rabbit hole. And I thought one of the most powerful moments yesterday was Fiona Hill, when she pleaded with members of the committee not to buy into debunked fake conspiracy theories that have been propagated by Russian military intelligence. Basically, you know, I'm not going to be part of a process that turns reality on its head, that tries to blame Ukraine for all of this. And it was a very pointed, I thought, very, very pointed pushback against Devin Nunes, but also to the President of the United States himself, who then goes on Fox and Friends Friday morning and begins to propagate this bizarre, I mean, we never landed on the moon, you know, level conspiracy theory.
Right, right.
And it's just, this is the moment where you go, are Republicans just going to go along with this? The answer, of course, yes, because I don't want it to be a spoiler alert here. But, you know, however bad the Republicans are in the committee, let's face it, the President of the United States is the conspiracy theorist in chief right now.
He is. We know that Russia has succeeded, at least in a matter of degrees, in influencing and dictating presidential decision-making behavior. We have seen that. What Fiona Hill made obvious to the nation as well is that we have Republican members of Congress who also have been successfully manipulated and are being used by the Russians. And on a case-by-case basis, you have to ask each member, is it simply out of ignorance? Is it because they are gullible? Is it because they are willing to be manipulated? Not necessarily that, you know, they're getting Russian money in their pocket, but because this advances a Fox News Trumpism narrative that helps them in supermajority Republican districts back home. But regardless of what the answer to those questions are on a case-by-case basis, Russia has succeeded in unduly influencing Republican members of Congress. That was Fiona Hill's testimony. And that was evident to see the questioning and, frankly, the complete ignoring of her plea. I would also say, as a country, if we move it outside of just the Republican Party context, the consistency of Fiona Hill's testimony with the closing statement of Bob Mueller is really should grab us and shake us a bit. You know, Bob Mueller's closing statement was, listen, this is happening now. We have to do something about this. Fiona Hill was, we have to do something about this going into 2020 now. Elijah Cummings, when he gave that impassioned presser earlier this spring, I believe, and said, this is not who we are. He wasn't just talking about the president's behavior and partisan behavior. He was talking about the willingness of a political class that is giving comfort to the interests of some of a nation state with whom we are adverse. You know, what the president did, it gets complicated for some over the phone call and so forth. But the president ultimately did is in secret. Right? He didn't want to get caught in secret. He tried to cheat us, the American voters, in the next election by secretly kneecapping his political opponent, Joe Biden. That's what he was doing. He was trying to cheat us. And in executing that scheme, he was willing to compromise our national security when it comes to Russia, not just Ukraine's, but by empowering Russian aggression into Ukraine. He is creating a stronger Russia. And Russia's interests are against our national security. The president of the United States was willing to let our national security erode when it comes to U.S.-Russia relations, our national security, for the sake of cheating in the next election in secret by kneecapping his opponent. Fiona Hill's plea to the country should have landed hard on Republican ears, but it really should land on all of us. Impeachment of the president doesn't satisfy the fact that we don't have the appropriate posture towards the threat of Russia as we sit here today.
You have just hit on some really crucial points that I want to pick up on in a moment. But let's hear a word from our sponsor first. Did you know that 70% of people say they want to use natural products, but only 2% do? That's why Grove Collaborative makes finding healthy, affordable, effective products easy and convenient. And now, more than 500,000 American households shop Grove for their healthy home essentials. Grove Collaborative is the online marketplace that delivers all natural home, beauty, and personal products directly to you. They take the guesswork out of going green. Every Grove product is guaranteed to be good for you, your family, your home, and the planet. My first box arrived, and it had just an incredible array of products that my wife and I are going to be trying out. I mean, it is an amazing smorgasbord of choices. Then they deliver all of your home essentials right to your front door, and they have this huge selection of sustainable plant-based products, including all the big brands that I love and I trust, like Mrs. Meyers and Method. Everything they carry is safer for you, better for the planet, and it really works. In place of the harsh chemicals, they use natural ingredients that smell fresh and leave your house sparkling. Look, we're all busy. I certainly am. And I know that I don't have time to waste buying detergent and toilet paper, and neither do you. So give it a try and get some me time back in your day. Because with Grove, you don't have to shop multiple stores or search endlessly online to get all the natural goods you need for you and your family. They have everything that I need in one place, which... I don't want to spend a lot of time doing this, but I want to get quality stuff. So, and they have the best selection of natural home and personal care products. Things for the house, my grandkids, my dog, even some fun personal things for me. So join more than 500,000 families who trust Grove Collaborative to make their homes happier and healthier. Plus, the shipping is fast and free on your first order. For a limited time, when listeners go to grove.co/bulwark, you'll get a free 5-piece gift set from Mrs. Meyers and festive holiday scents like peppermint or Iowa pine. So go to grove.co/bulwark to get this exclusive holiday offer. That's grove.co/bulwark. Okay, we are back with former Congressman David Jolly. You know, you mentioned a very, very interesting thing, connecting the dots between Fiona Hill's comments and Bob Mueller's. And I think this is another reason why I think Democrats should perhaps slow their roll a little bit, to continually emphasize that what's happening is ongoing. It's not just something that happened in the past. It's happening right now, that the president of the United States engaged in a corrupt scheme to affect the next election, and that it is ongoing because he continues to provide cover for the Russians. I mean, Vladimir Putin is basically spiking the football this week, saying, here's the good news. Nobody's blaming Russia anymore. They're all blaming Ukraine. Well, you know, the warning that we've been hearing again and again from Bob Mueller and throughout the intelligence community is that the Russian effort is ongoing. They will attempt to affect and corrupt the 2020 election. The president is not only standing up to protect the integrity of that election, he continues to aid and abet the Russians by deflecting attention. So these are all things that I think the Democrats need to continually make the case. From a political point of view, I think the last 2 weeks was immensely effective. But if we've learned anything, David, it's how quickly we forget things, what short attention spans we have.
Right.
So Alexander Vindman testified about 2 months ago, right?
Right.
It was
yeah,
Monday.
Right, right. Behind closed doors. But yes. It feels like 2 months ago this week.
I mean, there was so much. It kept coming. The hits kept coming very, very dramatically. And yet here we're sitting here on a Friday, and I feel like we've experienced this over the last 3 years. As you look back on Friday, you go, wow, that happened this week. Oh, to a certain extent, the Democrats' success was also one of the liabilities, that there was just so much stuff. It's hard for us to absorb it. And I think that speed is not their friend at this point, especially going into the holidays, that sometimes you need to repeat, you need to clarify, you need to allow public opinion to marinate in what we've learned and what we need to learn.
I would agree with that. And one of the elements in this as a country is, at some point, though it is on us as a nation to be active citizens and to be active voters and to hold our members of Congress accountable. In a representative democracy like we have, we entrust our leaders to take care of business in a full-time way, right? The American voter is also working on matters with their place of employment, their place of worship, their family, their civic organization, the ball field down the road. We should be able to place an element of trust and our elected leaders, whether we voted for them or not, whether they're a member of our party or not, trust that they have custodianship of this great ship of democracy and they're attending to this responsibly. I think the anxiety many voters feel in this moment is that we don't fully trust our elected leaders to do their job. And that includes staying on top of this threat, staying on top of the urgency of it, and working through these issues in a way that we as a nation can clearly understand. I mean, our leaders got this, right? Even to the point of, if they decide to impeach the president or not, that's okay. We trust them. We trust they're going to do the right thing. We're not there. We're simply not there. And the one tool we have is to beat the people that we can't put our trust in. If it's on the matter of impeachment, or if it's on the matter of responding to the urgency of the threat of Russia, if we see a leader like Mitch McConnell who refuses to move election security legislation for reasons that make absolutely no sense, we should try to beat him. That's the answer, because that's the only tool of accountability we have. And I think we could apply that standard to a lot of members who are missing this moment in history as we sit on the sidelines and watch.
Yeah, one of the, you know, I agree with that, because, and there are very, very few alternatives to all of that. Before I move on to something else, though, I thought that one of the strongest things that Adam Schiff said in his closing remarks yesterday was the whole question of timing, that Trump's phone call with President Zelensky took place the day after the Mueller testimony. And that's significant, because it indicated, you know, what a president, Trump, who felt that he was going to be able to get away with anything, how he would behave. And I think that was really an interesting point, that if you have a president of the United States who is not held accountable by Congress, not held accountable by the voters, what would a second term be like? He's made it very, very clear, you know, how he will behave if he thinks that he's not going to get caught and he's not going to be held accountable. That is terrifying. Now, having said all of this, what is your take now on how the Democratic presidential race is unfolding? Because it sort of seems like a split screen where we're watching all of the trials and tribulations of the Trump administration, but the Democrats have really struggled to get their act together. So what's your sense of the race right now after this week's debate that nobody watched?
The direction of the Democratic Party is not a moderate direction. It's a progressive direction. That's the one thing we know. Even if you look at where the polls that still have Biden out front, So he may be in the high 20s to low 30s. All the remainder of candidates who are competing with him are in the progressive wing, and they are, you know, making up a majority of the party. So, look, I'm not a Democrat, and it is not my place to tell the Democrats where to go. It's my place to say, I think we have to get Donald Trump out of office, and I'll be your partner in getting your nominee elected in November. I still think the Democrats have a good opportunity to choose the direction they want to go. And ultimately, inevitably, it's going to be the progressive direction. And I think they will match up fine against Donald Trump. I'm less worried. I'm not in the camp that Democrats have to nominate a moderate. I'm really not. I think the contrast is going to be clear, regardless of who they nominate. And whomever they nominate, Donald Trump's going to label them a socialist with a criminal background. The Republicans are going to spend $1 billion to drive up the negative of the Democratic nominee regardless. So I think Democrats should embrace who they want. Now, there are some finer points to messaging in politics. And so I make the case that, you know, that the challenge with the Medicare for All platform, for instance, is not always in the finer points of economics of healthcare. Voters often get lost around that. It is around the idea of tax increase, but more importantly, the difference between Medicare for All and a public option. Medicare for All is telling voters they must, and a public option is telling them they may. And so if you are going to be the party that thinks Medicare for All is a solution, maybe that's the step after a public option, because I think a public option would poll very well, right? Voters, if you want to try this, you can. You're welcome to. We're going to create a system where you can move into a Medicare program. And if it works well, then we're going to move to Medicare for All. You can embrace your vision of Medicare for All, but I think there are some issues around some of their harder progressive issues that they may want to think about how they try to make the case to the American people. I still think Democrats are in a strong position to win. I am sympathetic to those who say Trump could very well get reelected. I think they're right. I still have a lot of confidence that Democrats beat Donald Trump next November.
I wish I shared that optimism, because I'm not quite so confident about all of that. I think that Donald Trump is quite possibly poised to be reelected in the swing states if the Democrats move too far left. However, I will say that I guess I also disagree. Over the last couple of weeks, I did see this moderate resurgence. It was like there was this moment after Elizabeth Warren came out with her Medicare for All plan that Democrats kind of slammed on the brakes and went, whoa, okay, this is going to be hard to go into the fall of 2020 with. Then you had Barack Obama coming out cautioning his fellow Democrats against going too far left, that Americans did not want revolutionary change. You started seeing the kind of, I don't think it's a good idea for Bloomberg to get in. I don't think Deval Patrick's going anywhere. But my sense was that Democrats kind of had a little reality jolt and remembered that the, you know, job number one is getting rid of Donald Trump. And I guess I'm a little bit heartened that there seems to be such a focus on getting rid of Donald Trump as opposed to scratching their ideological id. So I'm more hopeful. By the way, have you had a chance to see this rather remarkable piece in The Atlantic about Joe Biden's stutter?
I had just started to look at that when we jumped on this podcast. So I haven't read through it, no, but I understand Stephanie Ruhle, actually somebody we often work with it. MSNBC was covering that story this morning as well.
Well, what's interesting about that the piece is extremely rare that you read a political article that will change your view of a candidate at this point, especially somebody who's been around forever.
Sure.
This guy's been around since Methuselah, and this was completely new to me that Joe Biden, as a young man, had a terrible stutter, that he was actually known as Stut, you know, and he had, you know, his stories of nuns who made fun of him, and that this is really one of the formative experiences of his life. But also, the writer of this piece, who also has this affliction, also stutters and continues to stutter very, very badly, approaches this very empathetically. And one of the underlying theories or thesis of the story is, or at least the question of the story is, Are Biden's stumbles now that might look like examples of senility really simply reflections of that old problem of stuttering? And it's and this may sound I'm not doing this justice, but it does goes sure. back to no, some I of understand. The moments of the debate, and you go, okay, so maybe the guy's not losing it. If you know that he has struggled with this for decades, it appears in a completely different light. So it's really an extraordinary story.
Yeah, look, I think Joe Biden would be a remarkable president, a strong, capable leader, and I think Democrats would be in great shape nominating him. I, you know, for those who at times are down on Biden, I'm up on most of the Democratic candidates. I found my role being the encourager when Democrats are kind of down with some of the infighting. I remind them that through polling, most candidates poll very well and ahead of Donald Trump. Look, Joe Biden would be a remarkable candidate. The one thing that we know of him is that he is a heart and soul guy. And if he has met and faced challenges in the past, he's been pretty open about them. When it comes to matters around his previous wife, his son, some of the challenges of serving, some of the challenges of how to be progressive on civil rights matters in an era where you couldn't really achieve the whole loaf, right? How do we contextualize his accomplishments on progressive civil rights issues in an era that was different than the era today? And then you have the corn pop moments, right? where Joe Biden tries to remind people, hey, I grew up in the neighborhood and I'm somebody who understands the walk of life from the local neighborhood pool all the way to the vice president's mansion. Joe Biden's a remarkable American servant. He'd be a great president. Democrats have a choice to make. I don't think there's a moderate and progressive lane per se. I think there's a Joe Biden lane and an everybody else lane. And I think that's been the challenge for Joe Biden.
Yeah, I don't know whether Joe Biden would be a great president. And I'll be honest with you, I really don't care.
I guess that's
honestly, if he just
that's
if
probably
he just,
what I'm referring to as well.
If he sits at the over, you know, at the desk, I know that a lot of our progressive listeners are going to go, oh, gosh, no, really, I think I've said this out loud that I'm actually okay with benign senility as opposed to toxic senility. I'm willing to die.
Here's my bumper sticker for 2020. Charlie, my bumper sticker for 2020 is bring back boring.
Yeah,
so
no,
to
no.
Your point,
I am totally
if
with
Joe
it.
Biden is simply a safe, boring president, we're great.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that he understands that return to normalcy, which is not a real word. Okay, well, one last thing in the time we have left. The president, one of the few lucid things the president said during his bizarre, crazy grandpa rant on Fox and Friends on Friday morning was he did hint that he might actually veto that congressional bill condemning China's behavior in Hong Kong. This thing was passed overwhelmingly. I think it was unanimous in the Senate and only one vote against it in the House of Representatives. The Chinese are absolutely furious about it and really saying, you know, this might screw up our trade talks. If Donald Trump vetoes this, and I'm not sure what the name of the bill, it's got a pretty strong name to it here. Let me see if I can just call this up. The Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. So the Chinese are saying if the U.S. side goes its own way, China will take effective measures to resolutely counteract it. All the consequences must be fully borne by the U.S. And the problem is you have this December 15th deadline for Trump to decide whether to renew these major tariffs on Chinese goods. So if Trump vetoes the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, it will go back to Congress for an override vote. What will Republicans do? Because, I mean, it would be a huge humiliation for the president to be overridden on that. And yet...
Many of them would vote. I think they vote to override. Look, the broader context in this is follow the money and follow the frail ego. His veto of this would be very consistent with his refusal to condemn Erdogan, in fact, even greenlighting Erdogan to go into Syria. It would be very similar with how he sided with the Crown Prince in the Khashoggi matter. Follow the money and follow the frail ego. He has business interests around the world. He knows China is a greater market than Hong Kong. And follow the frail ego in that This is somebody who likes to have a seat at the table with world leaders. And unlike some of the world leaders that he currently works with, particularly those with malintent, they will be there long after he's gone, and he's going to want to be able to sit at the table with them as an ex-president. And I think the motivation for his behavior in this moment, and when it comes to Turkey, when it comes to Saudi Arabia, look at different spots around the globe, is a confluence of his financial interests and his egotistical.
Okay, so I agree
and
with
I think
you.
That's all it is.
But what will Republicans do? Because you can imagine him putting a lot of pressure that, you know, on Republicans. So let's take Lindsey Graham. You know, the old Lindsey Graham would have definitely voted to override. The current Lindsey Graham is capable of blocking a resolution condemning Armenian genocide because he doesn't want to embarrass Erdogan. So is a Lindsey Graham going to potentially vote to override the president's veto if it undermines the president in these trade negotiations? I mean, I could see Republicans caving in on this, too.
And they may. I mean, you certainly may be right. I wouldn't put an ounce of faith in Lindsey Graham, you know, if I'm in a sinking boat and need a lifeline thrown to me. So cross him off the list. But you could look at the Saudi measures when it came to sanctions on Saudi after the Khashoggi murder. And you saw a number of Republican senators who simply wouldn't protect the president in that moment. And I think both the White House, if not the president, but at least Kellyanne Conway and Republican senators also know that if you're going to break with the president, this is a matter that is not something that informs voters' decisions at the polls. This is not a hugely controversial matter for voters. And so in some ways, not only does it allow Republican senators to continue with their vote of conviction, but they can somewhat manipulatively be able to tell their local editorial boards and their Republican constituents, look, I've been independent from the president where I think he's wrong. And here's a case, Hong Kong, Saudi Arabia, the ones that you voters maybe care less about than when it comes to the tax bill and health care and kids in cages. But I've shown a willingness to break from the president because I'm an independent. It does play into that narrative a little bit in a pretty safe political issue arena that won't inform voters' decisions in 2020.
That's plausible, and that's probably the way it's going to play out. But I can also see the Republicans being told, look, the one thing that you don't want to have happen in 2020 is an economic downturn, and a renewed trade war with China would make that far more likely. So this is not just about human rights. It's not just about you distancing yourself. You could actually be casting a vote that will lead to economic backlash that could wipe us all out. And I can certainly imagine that as well. Look, I'm so used to disappointment here, as I think we started off on that. You know, we could add this to another list of our regrets that we have. But I think it's going to be this is going to be an interesting test for Republicans in Congress. And it's interesting that they put Trump in this position, and Trump obviously, you know, is going to do what he does, because we know that his commitment to promoting human rights and democracy abroad is pretty much close to zero. So I agree with you on that. David Jolly, thank you so much for spending so much time with me on a Friday morning.
Always great to be with you, Charlie. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. Today's episode was brought to you by Grove Collaborative. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.